This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 1994 examination, in English as a second language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are six questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each question twice. Question 1. One of your neighbors wants to borrow a hammer. Your father asks you to take it round. Where exactly is it?
Look, Mrs. Wilson was on the phone just now. She wants to put up a picture in the dining room. Can you go round with my hammer? It's in the drawer in the kitchen. Look, Mrs. Wilson was on the phone just now. She wants to put up a picture in the dining room. Can you go round with my hammer? It's in the drawer in the kitchen.
Question 2. Sammy's mother has telephoned his sports teacher. Why can't he play football?
Hello, Mr. Thomas. It's Sammy's mother here. I'm afraid Sammy won't be playing in the football match this afternoon. His uncle is arriving today from Australia, and he wants to come with us to meet him at the station. Hello, Mr. Thomas. It's Sammy's mother here. I'm afraid Sammy won't be playing in the football match this afternoon. His uncle is arriving today from Australia, and he wants to come with us to meet him at the station.
Question 3. Ali is talking to his friend Brian. Why does Ali not want to play football? Give two reasons.
Look, we played football yesterday, and the day before, and the day before that, and I'm really fed up with it. Why can't we play basketball? We haven't played it for ages. Look, we played football yesterday, and the day before, and the day before that. And I'm really fed up with it. Why can't we play basketball? We haven't played it for ages.
Question 4. Sally is telling a friend about her holiday. Why does Sally not have any photographs of her holiday?
I had a really great holiday. But one or two things did go wrong. Not only did I manage to leave my camera in a restaurant, I also had my watch stolen somewhere around the bus station. Anyway, I won't be boring you with hundreds of pictures this year. I had a really great holiday, but one or two things did go wrong. Not only did I manage to leave my camera in a restaurant, I also had my watch stolen somewhere around the bus station. Anyway, I won't be boring you with hundreds of pictures this year.
Question 5. You're on holiday and are looking for the cinema. You ask a passerby for directions. How do you get there?
The cinema? Well, if you turn left here at the garage... Right. You'll see the cinema about 500 metres down the road, opposite the supermarket. You'll see the cinema about 500 metres down the road, opposite the supermarket.
Question 6. You arrive home from school to find Mr. Johnson talking to your father. What did Mr. Johnson do last night? Why?
It's just ridiculous. I've told him time and time again that if he couldn't keep that music of his down, I'd call the police. Well, the noise was so bad last night that I did phone them. And they came round this morning and told him that if they had one more complaint from his neighbours, they'd come and take away his equipment.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at part two, exercise one. Part two. Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to this college lecturer talking to a group of new students and complete the notes below. You will hear the lecturer twice.
Okay. If I could just have a bit of quiet, please. Now, as you probably know, my name's Mr. Thomas. I'm the deputy head of the arts faculty. Can I first of all welcome you all to the college? I hope that for all of you, the next 3 years will be both happy and successful. What I'd like to do this morning is give you some information about the college and explain to you where all the important things are. So if you could take some notes of what I'm going to say, I think you'll find them useful. Now, as I'm sure you realise, this is the largest college in the country. We've got around 8,000 students altogether this year. I think the next biggest has something like 5,500. So there are some good things that come from the size of the place, and equally, the fact that we are so big gives us, and you for that matter, a few problems. Now, as you can imagine, it's something of a nightmare organising a place as big as this. Perhaps the most important thing for me to tell you is that we've set up a new students' information service. If you don't know where you're supposed to go or what subject you're supposed to have at any particular time of the day,
the staff at the information service will be able to tell you. It's located in the library, second floor, right next to the lift. Another thing designed to help you is the fact that each of you has been given what we call an advisor of studies. They're all lecturers in the college with lots of experience in helping students, and, of course, they've all been students themselves, so they know how you feel. Although in some cases it's really quite a long time since they were in your shoes. Now, you all have an appointment with your advisor at some time this week, so the place to go for information about who your advisor is and when and where you're supposed to see him or her is on the large notice board to the left of the main entrance to the refectory. Another thing you should know about is the doctor's surgery, which is on the ground floor near the science faculty. It used to be open every afternoon, but sadly now with all the cutbacks, the doctors are only available on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Actually, you can always get hold of medical help through your faculty office, but I suppose the message from me would be not to get sick on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Now, what else? Ah, yes. If you're looking for help on things like careers, perhaps it's a bit early for you to start thinking about jobs now, but it can't do any harm, or accommodation, or even if you've got financial worries, the place to go is Student Services, which is located in the building on the edge of the playing fields. Now, that reminds me that if you're interested in any clubs or societies, there's an opportunity on Wednesday of this week, that's the 6th of October, to meet representatives and members of all our clubs in the large coffee lounge next to the TV room. I advise you all to go along to see what's on offer. I think you'll find something to suit your interests. And there is no point in spending all your time here with your nose stuck in a book. I think that as a way of meeting people, especially people who aren't doing the same course as you, there is no better way than to join one of our clubs. I think I read somewhere that we have over 60 clubs and societies, which can't be bad, can it? Now, I think that's about all I have to say for the moment. But if anyone has any questions, I'd be more than happy to try to answer them. And,
Now you will hear the lecturer again.
Okay. If I could just have a bit of quiet, please. Now, as you probably know, my name's Mr. Thomas. I'm the deputy head of the arts faculty. Can I first of all welcome you all to the college? I hope that for all of you, the next 3 years will be both happy and successful. What I'd like to do this morning is give you some information about the college and explain to you where all the important things are. So if you could take some notes of what I'm going to say, I think you'll find them useful. Now, as I'm sure you realize, this is the largest college in the country. We've got around 8,000 students altogether this year. I think the next biggest has something like 5,500. So there are some good things that come from the size of the place, and equally, the fact that we are so big gives us, and you for that matter, a few problems. Now, as you can imagine, it's something of a nightmare organizing a place as big as this. Perhaps the most important thing for me to tell you is that we've set up a new students' information service. If you don't know where you're supposed to go or what subject you're supposed to have at any particular time of the day, the staff at the information service will be able to tell you. It's located in the library, second floor, right next to the lift. Another thing designed to help you is the fact that each of you has been given what we call an advisor of studies. They're all lecturers in the college with lots of experience in helping students. And, of course, they've all been students themselves, so they know how you feel. Although in some cases it's really quite a long time since they were in your shoes. Now, you all have an appointment with your advisor at some time this week, so the place to go for information about who your advisor is and when and where you're supposed to see him or her is on the large notice board to the left of the main entrance to the refectory. Another thing you should know about is the doctor's surgery, which is on the ground floor near the science faculty. It used to be open every afternoon, but sadly, now with all the cutbacks, the doctors are only available on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Actually, you can always get hold of medical help through your faculty office, but I suppose the message from me would be not to get sick on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Now, what else? Ah, yes. If you're looking for help on things like careers, perhaps it's a bit early for you to start thinking about jobs now, but it can't do any harm, or accommodation, or even if you've got financial worries, the place to go is Student Services, which is located in the building on the edge of the playing fields. Now, that reminds me that if you're interested in any clubs or societies, there's an opportunity on Wednesday of this week, that's the 6th of October, to meet representatives and members of all our clubs in the large coffee lounge next to the TV room. I'd advise you all to go along to see what's on offer. I think you'll find something to suit your interests. And there is no point in spending all your time here with your nose stuck in a book. I think that as a way of meeting people, especially people who aren't doing the same course as you, there is no better way than to join one of our clubs. I think I read somewhere that we have over 60 clubs and societies, which can't be bad, can it? Now, I think that's about all I have to say for the moment. But if anyone has any questions, I'd be more than happy to try to answer them. And,
That is the end of exercise one. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for exercise two. Exercise 2. Questions 8 to 17. Listen to the following radio broadcast and answer the questions by putting a tick or a cross in the appropriate box to show if the statements are true or false. You will hear the broadcast twice.
Well, good evening and welcome to this week's Good Health program. We have a very full program for you tonight, including news of an amazing new way of preventing tooth decay in children, and how to lose weight by actually eating more. More on that later. Our first item should be of real interest to those of you who are drivers, and who are part of a substantial minority who find night driving something of a problem. I actually quite enjoy driving at night myself, but I've got Mark Taylor from the motoring organisation Safety First to tell us about how modern technology is making driving at night much safer. Mark, tell us about these new night driving glasses.
Yes.
It certainly is an important development and should save the lives of quite a number of drivers and pedestrians each year. I think a lot of people have real difficulties just at that time of day when it's beginning to get dark and with everyone's headlights on, you're suddenly plunged into a world of flashing lights and shadowy pedestrians. I think for some people this is actually quite frightening because they have real difficulty in focusing, and clearly that is just a recipe for disaster.
Of course. But what actually goes wrong with people's sight at times like this?
Well, it's taken quite a long time to really understand this, but these people are actually suffering from a kind of night blindness, which is said to affect no fewer than 20% of the driving population. What happens is that the muscles relax and let in more light, so that distant images become blurred. During the day, it is colours and other stimuli which allow the brain to sort of warn us to focus on an object. But at night, the colours aren't there, and we tend to rely on shadows or silhouettes.
Yes, I see. Okay, but what is this new development? And how did scientists come up with this idea of night glasses?
I'm told it started with fighter pilots who were required to fly at night and for whom a special set of night flying equipment had to be developed. Well, when this equipment was developed, they discovered that many of the pilots just couldn't use it properly. I think this is what has brought about the need to develop these night glasses.
Right. And how do people get to know they have a problem?
Well, the first signs are when you have trouble seeing distant objects, which all seem to merge together. Just because you can see perfectly clearly during the day is no guarantee that you will have no problems at night. As far as I can gather, the first time that most people realise there is a problem is when they actually have a near miss, or even worse, an accident. Well, I can give you an example.
Yes, I can see that it could be very serious indeed. Oh, I'm sorry. You were about to give an example, I think.
Yes. One of our members, who didn't like night driving because it made her eyes ache, made a habit of letting her husband do the driving at night. But one particular night she was on her own and swerved to avoid a car which had cut right across her path, and she went right up onto the curb.
Ooh.
In fact, the road did narrow at that point, but she just didn't see the curb and is now more than a bit shaken by the experience.
Yes.
And the real problem for this person is that she's a driving instructor.
Oh, dear. I see. So she now has a set of these glasses.
Yes, she does. They use a special machine to test people's eyes. Ordinary equipment just won't do. And give them a prescription for a special set of lenses. One of the interesting things about the tests they do is that often the eyes are perfectly okay. Some patients can put the problem right by reducing the strain on their eyes or by becoming generally healthier. There are also some eye exercises which can help in reducing the problem and which can mean that patients don't need to invest in the night glasses. It is amazing, however, what the night glasses can do for those whose night vision really is bad. They put everything back into very sharp focus and really give the driver a greater sense of confidence in his or her driving ability. I think the really worrying thing is that there are probably thousands of drivers out there who, by daytime vision standards, are actually driving illegally and endangering lives every time they get behind the wheel. One good thing to come out of this is that in some countries, Canada, Sweden, and Norway, for example, there is a lot of pressure for drivers to go through some sort of annual test in the same way as their cars have to. And that really will highlight the problem of poor night vision.
Well, it certainly does sound pretty serious. And I certainly hadn't realized the extent of the problem. Have you any final piece of advice for any drivers listening who may be worried about their vision at night?
Yes, the only thing I would say is that drivers who know their eyesight at night is not too good should take things slowly and simply give their brains more time to register small objects around them, on the road and on the pavements.
Well, thank you, Mark Taylor, for that fascinating, if alarming, insight into the world of night driving. Our next item goes right to the pockets of all of us who shop at supermarkets and concerns the rising costs of...
now you will hear the broadcast again.
Well, good evening and welcome to this week's Good Health Programme. We have a very full programme for you tonight, including news on an amazing new way of preventing tooth decay in children, and how to lose weight by actually eating more. More on that later. Our first item should be of real interest to those of you who are drivers and who are part of a substantial minority who find night driving something of a problem. I actually quite enjoy driving at night myself, but I've got Mark Taylor from the motoring organisation Safety First to tell us about how modern technology is making driving at night much safer. Mark, tell us about these new night driving glasses.
Yes. It certainly is an important development and should save the lives of quite a number of drivers and pedestrians each year. I think a lot of people have real difficulties just at that time of day when it's beginning to get dark and with everyone's headlights on, you're suddenly plunged into a world of flashing lights and shadowy pedestrians. I think for some people this is actually quite frightening because they have real difficulty in focusing, and clearly that is just a recipe for disaster.
Of course. But what actually goes wrong with people's sight at times like this?
Well, it's taken quite a long time to really understand this, but these people are actually suffering from a kind of night blindness, which is said to affect no fewer than 20% of the driving population. What happens is that the muscles relax and let in more light, so that distant images become blurred. During the day, it is colours and other stimuli which allow the brain to sort of warn us to focus on an object. But at night, the colours aren't there, and we tend to rely on shadows or silhouettes.
Yes, I see. Okay, but what is this new development? And how did scientists come up with this idea of night glasses?
I'm told it started with fighter pilots who were required to fly at night and for whom a special set of night flying equipment had to be developed. Well, when this equipment was developed, they discovered that many of the pilots just couldn't use it properly. I think this is what has brought about the need to develop these night glasses.
Right. And how do people get to know they have a problem?
Well, the first signs are when you have trouble seeing distant objects, which all seem to merge together. Just because you can see perfectly clearly during the day is no guarantee that you will have no problems at night. As far as I can gather, the first time that most people realise there is a problem is when they actually have a near miss, or even worse, an accident. Well, I can give you an example.
Yes, I can see that it could be very serious indeed. Oh, I'm sorry. You were about to give an example, I think.
Yes. One of our members, who didn't like night driving because it made her eyes ache, made a habit of letting her husband do the driving at night. But one particular night, she was on her own and swerved to avoid a car which had cut right across the path, and she went right up onto the curb.
Ooh.
Well, in fact, the road did narrow at that point, but she just didn't see the curb and is now more than a bit shaken by the experience.
Yes.
And the real problem for this person is that she's a driving instructor.
Oh, dear. I see. So she now has a set of these glasses.
Yes, she does. They use a special machine to test people's eyes. Ordinary equipment just won't do. And give them a prescription for a special set of lenses. One of the interesting things about the tests they do is that often the eyes are perfectly okay. Some patients can put the problem right by reducing the strain on their eyes or by becoming generally healthier. There are also some eye exercises which can help in reducing the problem and which can mean that patients don't need to invest in the night glasses. It is amazing, however, what the night glasses can do for those whose night vision really is bad. They put everything back into very sharp focus and really give the driver a greater sense of confidence in his or her driving ability. I think the really worrying thing is that there are probably thousands of drivers out there who, by daytime vision standards, are actually driving illegally and endangering lives every time they get behind the wheel. One good thing to come out of this is that in some countries, Canada, Sweden, and Norway, for example, there is a lot of pressure for drivers to go through some sort of annual test in the same way as their cars have to. And that really will highlight the problem of poor night vision.
Well, it certainly does sound pretty serious. And I certainly hadn't realized the extent of the problem. Have you any final piece of advice for any drivers listening who may be worried about their vision at night?
Yes, the only thing I would say is that drivers who know their eyesight at night is not too good should take things slowly and simply give their brains more time to register small objects around them, on the road and on the pavements.
Well, thank you, Mark Taylor, for that fascinating, if alarming, insight into the world of night driving. Our next item goes right to the pockets of all of us who shop at supermarkets. May be worried about their vision at night?
Yes, the only thing I would say is that drivers who know their eyesight at night is not too good should take things slowly and simply give their brains more time to register small objects around them, on the road and on the pavements.
Well, thank you, Mark Taylor, for that fascinating, if alarming, insight into the world of night driving. Our next item goes right to the pockets of all of us who shop at supermarkets and concerns the rising cost.
That is the end of part two. There will be a short break before you hear part three. Thank you. moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Exercise 1. Questions 18 to 22. Listen to the following extract from a radio program about sport and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
And with that interview from the league's top goalscorer, it's time to turn our attention to the more graceful world of golf. What I wasn't aware of until the other day is that, surprisingly perhaps, golf has become something of a political battlefield in certain parts of the world, as Carol Wilkins explained.
Yes, the problem comes really from golf courses in so-called developing countries. In many of these places, golf courses are seen as an important way of attracting foreign tourists, especially the Japanese, it seems, to visit certain countries and spend lots of money. Now, that sounds all right, but the truth is that when new golf courses are developed, local people are sometimes forced off their land, and often very dangerous fertilizers are used to improve the land. I can even quote you one case where 1,000 local people were moved away simply because the golf course developer regarded their homes as unsightly. They weren't even in the way of the development. Often, as well, scarce resources such as water are used. And in many people's opinion, it's difficult to justify all this for what is, after all, a simple game. I talked to Lynn Simpson, who represents a group which is trying to discourage the development of golf courses.
In Britain, it's bad enough when new golf courses take over large areas of farming land. But as we're just beginning to realise, the problem elsewhere is much worse. At least in Britain, the game is played by a large number of the local people, who, I suppose, are perfectly happy to pay that price in environmental terms. In other countries, however, the game of golf has no local following, and is set up only to attract the tourist. In Southeast Asia, for example, Thailand, the Philippines and Malaysia, it is quite clear that golf is no longer a matter of a pleasant way to pass a few hours in the open air, but is simply a matter of big business and profit for big companies. Look, I'll give you an example. It is actually cheaper for Japanese golfers to fly to Thailand and back for a game of golf than it is for them to buy a membership at some exclusive club at home. I suppose I'd be a lot more sympathetic if the local people of these poorer countries actually saw some of the profits, but very little is put back into the local economy. Many people, like myself, are extremely concerned at this situation, in spite of the fact that we can see very clearly the attractions of the game itself.
Sounds awful, doesn't it? And all for the rather silly pastime of trying to get a small white ball into a hole in the ground. Anyway, I thought I'd try to get another point of view and managed to contact a representative of a large American company which is in the golf course development business in the Philippines. I spoke to the public relations manager about this idea that golf courses could cause pollution.
Look, this is the sort of nonsense you'd expect from environmentalists these days. Okay, we get a fair bit of profit from the courses we built near Manila, but we pay wages to a wide variety of people who work for us, and that must be good for the local economy. We do try, where possible, to use local contractors when we build the courses in the first place, so that gives more local people more money. Any sort of progress has an environmental cost and unfortunately creates some pollution. But we feel that the benefits to the local people are enormous. I've even heard it suggested that golf courses are responsible for damage to forests and to marine life. All nonsense. People should be glad that we're prepared to take the risk of building these courses and not to keep on moaning about pollution that often doesn't exist or about local people who are not benefiting from what we do.
Well, clearly there is some sort of difference of opinion here. We'd like to find out what you think about this. Write to us and give us your view. We'll give you our address at the end of the program. Now, back to Ian for some news on the basketball scene in Canada. Now you will hear the extract again.
And with that interview from the league's top goalscorer, it's time to turn our attention to the more graceful world of golf. What I wasn't aware of until the other day is that, surprisingly perhaps, golf has become something of a political battlefield in certain parts of the world, as Carol Wilkins explains.
Yes. The problem comes really from golf courses in the so-called developing countries. In many of these places, golf courses are seen as an important way of attracting foreign tourists, especially the Japanese, it seems, to visit certain countries and spend lots of money. Now, that sounds all right, but the truth is that when new golf courses are developed, local people are sometimes forced off their land. And often very dangerous fertilizers are used to improve the land. I can even quote you one case where 1,000 local people were moved away simply because the golf course developer regarded their homes as unsightly. They weren't even in the way of the development. Often, as well, scarce resources such as water are used. And in many people's opinion, it's difficult to justify all this for what is, after all, a simple game. I talked to Lynn Simpson, who represents a group which is trying to discourage the development of golf courses.
In Britain, it's bad enough when new golf courses take over large areas of farming land. But as we're just beginning to realise, the problem elsewhere is much worse. At least in Britain, the game is played by a large number of the local people, who, I suppose, are perfectly happy to pay that price in environmental terms. In other countries, however, the game of golf has no local following, and is set up only to attract the tourist. In Southeast Asia, for example, Thailand, the Philippines, and Malaysia, it is quite clear that golf is no longer a matter of a pleasant way to pass a few hours in the open air. But it's simply a matter of big business and profit for big companies. Look, I'll give you an example. It is actually cheaper for Japanese golfers to fly to Thailand and back for a game of golf than it is for them to buy a membership at some exclusive club at home. I suppose I'd be a lot more sympathetic if the local people of these poorer countries actually saw some of the profits. But very little is put back into the local economy. Many people, like myself, are extremely concerned at this situation, in spite of the fact that we can see very clearly the attractions of the game itself.
Sounds awful, doesn't it? and all for the rather silly pastime of trying to get a small white ball into a hole in the ground. Anyway, I thought I'd try to get another point of view, and managed to contact a representative of a large American company which is in the golf course development business in the Philippines. I spoke to the public relations manager about this idea that golf courses could cause pollution.
Look, this is the sort of nonsense you'd expect from an environmentalist these days. Okay, we get a fair bit of profit from the courses we build near Manila, but we pay wages to a wide variety of people who work for us, and that must be good for the local economy. We do try, where possible, to use local contractors when we build the courses in the first place, so that gives more local people more money. Any sort of progress has an environmental cost and unfortunately creates some pollution. But we feel that the benefits to the local people are enormous. I've even heard it suggested that golf courses are responsible for damage to forests and to marine life. All nonsense. People should be glad that we're prepared to take the risk of building these courses and not to keep on moaning about pollution that often doesn't exist or about local people who are not benefiting from what we do.
Well, clearly there is some sort of difference of opinion here. We'd like to find out what you think about this. Write to us and give us your view. We'll give you our address at the end of the program. Now, back to Ian for some news on the basketball scene in Canada.
That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Exercise 2, questions 23 to 26. Listen to this spokesman for the people who live in Rosemount Square and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the spokesman twice.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you all for coming to this press conference. As you know, I represent the Residents' Committee for the Rosemount Square Complex, and we thought it would be a good idea to hold this meeting to get our point of view across to the public at large. All the other parties in this shambles seem to have had ample opportunity to explain their position, and we felt it was high time that we had an opportunity to do the same. For us, Rosemount Square is first and foremost our home, and not some sort of museum. It's time people listen to the voice of those who actually live here. Now, I think it may be important to give you all a bit of background first. Now, Rosemount Square. not actually a square at all, but a perfect circle with a courtyard in the middle of it. It was built in 1939. And as far as I can see, nobody at that time thought it was anything special. It had, and still has, of course, some 9 arches with carvings above them. But to many of us, it is just rather an ordinary place to live. We're just ordinary people who want the same rights as anyone else. This place is our home. Though to judge from the dozens of tourists with cameras we get around here, summer and winter, it's clearly a bit special as far as some people are concerned. You'd think it was a famous castle instead of a series of homes where normal people live. I sometimes think that if we were a little less friendly to the sightseers, we might just be left alone. And I'm just amazed that these people don't have better things to do on their holidays. And yet, the truth is that there aren't many buildings like this in the country. And while you might expect us to welcome the public attention, the fact is that being special has nothing but drawbacks as far as we're concerned. The government thinks that this is such an important building that it's put it in a category of buildings that have serious restrictions in terms of what can be done to them. In fact, we don't want to do anything except make them warm and dry in as modern a way as possible. But the authorities won't even let us do that. To them, it's a simple issue. Nothing must change in the square, and it must remain exactly as it was over 50 years ago. Well, I suppose, in a nutshell, we want to modernise Rosemount Square, and the authorities want it to stay the way it has always been. Well, I think it's probably impossible for an outsider to work out why they're making such a fuss about a building that is only 50 years old and is occupied by normal, ordinary people like myself. But let me give you some examples of the sort of problems we have at Rosemount. Our windows are made of metal, and we'd like to replace them with the sort of modern units everyone else has. No chance. These old windows are extremely difficult to clean, as well as being very inefficient in terms of keeping out the cold. Many of the residents have said that they'll simply go ahead and install new windows themselves if they don't get permission from the local authority. But if they do that, they risk having them forcibly removed and replaced with the originals, and all at the cost of the tenant. In other words, we can go ahead and do what we want, but we'll have nothing but expense and heartbreak. Night after night, our residents see adverts for modern replacement windows on television and in the papers, and it is extremely frustrating to realise that while everyone else can have what they want, we have to carry on with high fuel bills and drafty rooms. If you were to ask me what I and the other residents are looking for, it would be something like simple common sense. It is crazy that a building such as ours should be regarded as something special. Our homes may look rather different from the outside, but from the inside they are just ordinary homes, and we want to be treated in the same way as everybody else. Now, are there any questions?
Now you will hear the spokesman again.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you all for coming to this press conference. As you know, I represent the Residents Committee for the Rosemount Square Complex, and we thought it would be a good idea to hold this meeting to get our point of view across to the public at large. All the other parties in this shambles seem to have had ample opportunity to explain their position, and we felt it was high time that we had an opportunity to do the same. For us, Rosemount Square is first and foremost our home, and not some sort of museum. It's time people listen to the voice of those who actually live here. Now, I think it may be important to give you all a bit of background first. Now, Rosemount Square, not actually a square at all, but a perfect circle with a courtyard in the middle of it, was built in 1939. And as far as I can see, nobody at that time thought it was anything special. It had, and still has, of course, some nine arches with carvings above them. But to many of us, it is just rather an ordinary place to live. We're just ordinary people who want the same rights as anyone else. This place is our home. Though to judge from the dozens of tourists with cameras we get around here, summer and winter, it's clearly a bit special as far as some people are concerned. Well, you'd think it was a famous castle instead of a series of homes where normal people live. I sometimes think that if we were a little less friendly to the sightseers, we might just be left alone. And I'm just amazed that these people don't have better things to do on their holidays. And yet, the truth is that there aren't many buildings like this in the country. And while you might expect us to welcome the public attention, the fact is that being special has nothing but drawbacks as far as we're concerned. The government thinks that this is such an important building that it's put it in a category of buildings that have serious restrictions in terms of what can be done to them. In fact, we don't want to do anything except make them warm and dry in as modern a way as possible, but the authorities won't even let us do that. To them, it's a simple issue. Nothing must change in the square, and it must remain exactly as it was over 50 years ago. Well, I suppose, in a nutshell, we want to modernise Rosemount Square, and the authorities want it to stay the way it has always been. Well, I think it's probably impossible for an outsider to work out why they're making such a fuss about a building that is only 50 years old and is occupied by normal, ordinary people like myself. But let me give you some examples of the sort of problems we have at Rosemount. Our windows are made of metal, and we'd like to replace them with the sort of modern units everyone else has. No chance. These old windows are extremely difficult to clean, as well as being very inefficient in terms of keeping out the cold. Many of the residents have said that they'll simply go ahead and install new windows themselves if they don't get permission from the local authority. But if they do that, they risk having them forcibly removed and replaced with the originals. And all at the cost of the tenant. In other words, we can go ahead and do what we want, but we'll have nothing but expense and heartbreak. Night after night, our residents see adverts for modern replacement windows on television and in the papers, and it is extremely frustrating to realise that while everyone else can have what they want, we have to carry on with high fuel bills and drafty rooms. If you were to ask me what I and the other residents are looking for, it would be something like simple common sense. It is crazy that a building such as ours should be regarded as something special. Our homes may look rather different from the outside, but from the inside they are just ordinary homes, and we want to be treated in the same way as everybody else. Now, are there any questions?
That is the end of part three, and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.